This parrot is no more. It has ceased to be. It's expired and gone to see its maker. This is a late parrot. It's a stiff, bereft of life. It rests in peace. If you hadn't nailed it to the perch, it would be pushing up the daisies. It's rung down the curtain and joined the choir invisible. This is an ex-parrot.
Well, I better replace it then.
That, of course, is the one and only John Cleese from the classic Monty Python Dead Parrot sketch. Cleese is the iconic comedian and actor and creator of the British sitcom Fawlty Towers. He's also a founding member of Monty Python, the troupe, which also featured Eric Idle, Graham Chapman, Michael Palin, Terry Jones, and Terry Gilliam, reinvented comedy with their silly and surreal blend of smart and hilarious humor. And now John Cleese is here to give us advice on how we can be more creative with his book, Creativity, A Short and Cheerful Guide. You probably won't reach the holy grail of creativity like Cleese and his fellow pythons, but who knows? We caught up with John at his home via Zoom to talk about his creative process and when it began. He believes it was when he was a student and had to write an essay about time. He decided to write an essay about why he didn't have time to write an essay.
I wasn't conscious enough in terms of sort of intellectual ideas to see that that was what was going on. I just thought it was funny, and I was disappointed that the teacher didn't think it was funny, and that he sort of said, no, you're not supposed to do that kind of thing. So I got into Cambridge on science, and it was very little room to be creative in science. You know, when you're young, you have to study it for 20 years. And then I got into the Footlights Club, which is like the Hasty Pudding at Harvard. And I discovered at that moment that I could write something sometimes in the evening when I finished my academic work, and it would make people laugh when I read it out. And I was kind of thrilled. And then I noticed things like, if I couldn't come up with a good ending for a sketch at night, I'd think about it and go to bed unresolved. And when I woke up in the morning, I made myself a coffee and sat down at the desk and just looked at it. Within 90 seconds, I would have the answer. And I thought, well, why didn't I have the answer last night? It was so easy this morning. And the only explanation is that my unconscious mind was working on it during the night. And then I had other experiences which confirmed that. And I began to think, well, what is this unconscious mind? This is not the Freudian unconscious mind. This is a very useful unconscious mind. And a psychologist friend of mine pointed out how much of your life is done by your unconscious. When you drive to office in the morning, you're not really aware of it at all. So a bit of you does the driving for you, so you think of other things. So it's all a question of handing stuff over to the unconscious.
Yeah, you have this great example of the power of the unconscious, this parody of a Church of England sermon that you wrote with Graham Chapman. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, we wrote a parody. We just thought it was funny about Lot and Sodom and how he's warned to leave Sodom. And he, on the hill, walking away with his family, and they've been told not to look around, and his wife does, and she's immediately turned into a pillar of salt, which is a very good story. And we wrote a sketch about it, about the preacher suddenly realizing how odd that was, having always taken it for granted. And then after that, I lost it, and I knew he was going to be cross with me, so I had to rewrite it again from memory. And when I'd done that, I discovered the original, and I compared them, and the second one was surprisingly better than the first. It was crisper and funnier, and you know, brevity is the soul of wit. It was just a little bit more brief and a little bit more punchy. And I thought, well, I wasn't trying to improve it, I was just trying to remember it. So again, I realized my mind must have been thinking about it. There's a very good book called Hare Brain Tortoise Mind about the faster way of thinking, which is hare brain that we all do all the time, and tortoise mind being much more meditative.
Yeah, it's written by a cognitive scientist named Guy Claxton, and you discovered
right,
this book.
It's a terrific book.
Yeah, 20 years ago. And tell me what you learned from Claxton's book.
Well, I learned that there are certain things that need to be done at their own pace. And in our world, we're always trying to make everything more efficient. And he gave some examples, like cooking a sauce. If you try and hurry it, it doesn't work. It needs a certain amount of time. And he quoted a hilarious Polish proverb, which is, sleep faster, we need the pillows. I think that's enormously funny. You can't sleep faster. Sleep is something you just have to take your time over it.
Yeah. I'm curious about your experiences with creative collaboration. You wrote many Monty Python sketches with Graham Chapman, and you also collaborated with Connie Booth on your legendary BBC sitcom, Fawlty Towers. How did these creative collaborations work?
With Chapman, it was much more about just being silly. Mm-hmm. And my weakness was sometimes to become a little bit too logical. Chapman would sit there puffing on his pipe and staring out of the window and suddenly say something wonderfully mad, which would get us out of the rut that I was getting us stuck in. Well, I was pushing the thing forward and Gray was sitting there puffing away, and he was never 100% present. Michael Palin has said a wonderful thing at his funeral, talked about him always being late. And then he said, memorial service, he said, but I like to feel that Graham is here with us now at this moment. And he paused and said, or at least he will be in another 45 minutes. Wonderful.
And I guess that we're all thinking how sad it is that a man of such talent, of such capability, the kindness, of such unusual intelligence, should now so suddenly be spirited away at the age of only 48, before he'd achieved many of the things of which he was capable, and before he'd had enough fun. Well, I feel that I should say nonsense. Good riddance to him, the freeloading bastard, I hope he's found.
But you see, he was able to stare into the distance and just see what popped in his mind, because I was doing the heavy lifting and driving the thing along and writing the bulk of it. When I was working with Connie, it was slightly similar because I was better on plot and she was better on character. She's a wonderful actress. Because she was such a good actress, she would suddenly say when I'd written something, she said, no, I wouldn't believe that. I don't think that the person would say that. And then I'd say, oh, yeah, you're right. And then we go back and slightly tweak the plot so that we made the emotions work. So I was looked after the plot and the emotions. And sometimes I think they're almost slightly different parts of the mind. Emotions is about the feelings, and the plot is about the logic.
Now, are we all agreed on what the fire bell sounds like?
Yes.
Well, now that's settled, we'll have the fire drill, which will commence in exactly 30 seconds from now. Thank you so much. What are you doing? I mean, are you just going to stand there?
There's only a few seconds.
Right, well, stay where you are, because obviously if there was a fire, you'd all be standing down here like this in the lobby, wouldn't you? And I go, why we bother? We should let you all burn.
And when I did Fish Called Wanda, what I discovered was that once or twice I just did a draft that was all about plot. And then I come back and do a draft that was all about character. And it was almost easier to do it alternately than to try and do them at the same time. But that's because I'm not as accomplished a writer as I would like to be.
Hmm. You say that when we're trying to be creative, there's a real lack of clarity during most of the process. What can we do to embrace the ambiguity that we often experience when we are trying to be creative?
Well, we got to realize that our culture absolutely worships clarity. And that if you try to be creative, by definition, you're going somewhere you haven't been before. So how can you be very clear about where you are or where you're going if you've never been there before? Nothing is familiar. You're in new territory. So you just have to say, well, I don't really know what's going on. I'm just handing it over to my unconscious and not trying to clarify it too soon. Because if you start trying to clarify it too soon, then you lose the creativity. You do need at some point to clarify it and then to bring your creative mind in. But if you do that too soon, you just destroy creative thought. I say that New thoughts are like babies that are easily strangled. So you get, the clearer you are and the more happy you are to embrace confusion and to say, I don't know. I don't know at the moment. Because if people said that, life would be much easier. One of the things that makes life so difficult is that people pretend that they know things when they don't. So if you just say, I don't know, I'm just playing with this, I don't know where it'll go, that sort of attitude.
Mm-hmm. In his book, The War of Art, Stephen Pressfield talks about what he considers to be the biggest obstacle to creative work, something he calls resistance, this negative force that's kind of like an inner critic and makes you too anxious and afraid to create. Is resistance something that you've had to deal with in your career?
Oh, yes, I used to, but I came to conclusions about it. There were periods when Gray and I were writing when it just flowed. And it was glorious, but other times when it didn't. And the first thing we discovered that was reassuring was that there was a sort of average each week, some 15 to 18 minutes of good sketch material, Monday to Friday. And once we realized that that happened, whether we had a good or a bad day on Monday, we just took the downtime, the arid periods, as just part of the whole process. And then the guy, the psychiatrist I helped write a couple of books with, Robin Skinner, said that Gregory Bateson had once said, you can't have a new idea till you've got rid of an old one. And I thought, that's interesting. So when it's not coming, when you're just sitting there and nothing's going, I now think of that, well, this is just a fallow period. But I need to go through this to get the other side. But it doesn't mean that I can't write or that I'm a bad person. It's just part of the process. Once you accept that there are fallow periods and fertile periods, then it's much lighter because you don't beat yourself up so much.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is the most creative Monty Python sketch that you and Graham Chapman wrote?
I was thinking about this the other day because some of them are more relentless than creative. I mean, the original idea. But I think that the silliest ones were things like the French taunter, the Arabs in the 101 Tales and all that kind of thing. I often had these extraordinarily baroque insults. And we thought that making the insults to call someone an empty-headed animal food truck wiper was funny. It was just so silly.
You don't frighten us, English pig dogs. Go and boil your bottom, sons of a silly person. I'll blow my nose at you, so-called Arthur King. You and all your silly English kniggets.
Well, what do you think is the most creative Monty Python movie?
Well, there are different ways. I mean, Life of Brian, I think, is the best movie because the story is the only time we really got a good story right.
You've got to think for yourselves. You're all individuals.
Yes, we're all individuals.
You're all different.
Yes, we are all different.
I'm not.
You all got to work it out for yourself.
Yes, we've got to work it out for ourselves.
Exactly.
And it's also about something very important, whereas Holy Grail was just a collection of sketches. And so for me, it was never quite as successful. I don't like the end of the film very much because it's all about Terry Gilliam creating these very fine visual images, which actually aren't awfully funny. Mm. But up to that, I think it's terribly funny, but it doesn't add up to anything. It's not about anything.
Is there one piece of advice that you could offer, what you think is the most important piece of advice that you could offer our listeners who want to be more creative?
Well, yes, I mean, it is in the book, and the advantage of the book is it takes only an hour to read. But basically what it's saying is that if you want to play, you have to create the conditions for play, and that means you have to find a space in your life which is quite separate from your ordinary life. So you need a place where you're not going to be interrupted, which could be your room with the door shut, or it could be a park if you don't have a room, but somewhere quiet where you're not going to be interrupted. And then you just need to sort of give yourself a very specific moment when you start and when you finish. And then you have to sit there as in meditation until all the mind settles and gets quieter. And then you just play, but you don't know where you're going. You have a particular problem and you just start thinking about it and you hand it over to your unconscious without trying to control the unconscious.
John Cleese, thank you very much.
Pleasure. God bless.
John Cleese is a comedian, actor, and writer, and founding member of Monty Python. He's also the author of Creativity, A Short and Cheerful Guide. Find out more about John at wpr.org/beta.
And now for something completely different.
What was instilled in us in art school was that it's okay to be inspired by the artists that came before you, but what you gotta do is always add something that's unique unto yourself into the mix.
Talking Heads drummer Chris France joins us to talk about his memoir, Remain in Love. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.